Disclaimer: this novelette is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual persons, events, or created location is entirely coincidental. Introduction. Sean Tanner sat at the pub bar and gulped another large whiskey. The barman watched him. His notion was as long as someone was sitting or standing, and did not look drunk, then it was okay to let them drink themselves into oblivion. Tanner kept drinking but showed no sign he was about to fall off his bar stool. The barman left him to it and served someone else. The pub needed modernizing. Sean looked at the brown patterned wallpaper that was curling at the edges. It reminded him of the wallpaper his mother and father had when he was a boy. Sean did not often think about the past, but now, he was glad of a comforting memory. Losing Rebecca had wrenched his heart out. Sean had attended her funeral 2 days earlier and accompanied her mother back to the remote island where she lived. Now, he was not sure what to do. Sarah Serking had advised him to take a couple of months off to help with the grieving process. Sean wasn't convinced it was such a good idea. It would give him too much time to dwell on things, and too much time to drown his sorrows. Tanner was on the mainland and staying at a small hotel up the road from the pub. He could not face going back to London and decided he would just as well stay put, close to Rebecca's mum. The small town provided enough amenities to fulfill his needs, so he was content enough. The pub door swung open, a group of lads entered. They were young and in high spirit. Tanner knew at once there could be trouble. Young men with testosterone coursing around their bodies posed a threat. He did not want or need any aggravation. The group circled Tanner as he tried to leave the pub. They presumably took his hasty retreat as a sign of fear. They were mistaken. The ringleader started roughing up Tanner, and the others soon followed. Tanner was having none of it and grabbed the ringleader by the throat. As Tanner elevated the lad off the ground, the other boys backed away, and the lad in his grasp thrashed helplessly. Eventually, Tanner released the boy, who sank to his knees coughing and spluttering. The rest of the lads hurled empty threats at Tanner as he left the pub. At his hotel, Sean Tanner opened his briefcase. Inside was a wafer-thin computer, a 9mm handgun, tracking devices, a satellite phone, and an assortment of explosives. Chapter 1, Lily. Lily Anderson Pritchard stood outside the small, independent clothes retailer whilst waiting for her friend Bonnie. Their plan was simple: Bonnie would discover high-priced items of clothing they could sell and throw them outside the shop to Lily. Lily would leg it and let Bonnie face the music. They had figured without the evidence they would not get into trouble. It turned out that the local community police officers had other ideas. Since the two girls were on CCTV footage carrying out their minor heist, they had to pay for the items or face the prospect of a caution. When the police left Lily's house, her mother looked at her in disbelief. "You are grounded for the next month, Missy," her mother hissed. "Whatever," said Lily, marching up to her room. "Are you going to allow her to speak to me like that?" Lily's father looked at his wife and reflected on what he ever saw in her. Her face was contorting to match the unpleasant woman she had become on the inside. "I'll go up and have a word with her. That'll be a waste of time. You've never disciplined her once since she was born." Marcus Anderson Pritchard walked up the stairs seemingly with the weight of the world on his shoulders. Life with his wife Audrey had taken its toll on him. He now stooped badly and seemed incapable or unwilling to stand tall. He knocked on his daughter's door and waited for her to allow him in. When she didn't open the door, he called her, but there was no reply. Audrey leapt up the stairs in a rage and swung open Lily's door. Lily was not in her room or inside the house. Her bedroom window was open, and the drainpipe that led down to the ground was bent, giving away her method of escape. The night was chilly. Summer was coming to an end, but there was still another month or two left before people would need to batten down the hatches for the storms. The weather had worsened in Britain. Summer was now spoilt by heat waves, and winters were becoming much harsher. Lily stood outside the only remaining pub in town. She phoned Bonnie. Bonnie answered, "Hi, Lily," she said. Bonnie, do you fancy coming into town? Lily didn't wait for an answer. She laughed. Mum grounded me for a month, but I've managed to escape. Bonnie thought. If you're grounded. I don't want to go against your mother. Chicken. She can't do anything to you. Even so, I can still get into trouble with my parents. Just come, I'm on my own. I don't want to go to the pub alone. Okay, but I'm not staying out all night like last time. My parents might ground me too. On top of a hill surrounded by bracken, a figure lay on the ground. Beside the figure, a high-powered rifle rested on a small tripod. The person reached a stainless steel flask and slowly unscrewed the top. A small cloud of steam escaped and drifted upwards. Gloved hands cradled a cup of hot tea, and the person sipped and waited. The town below was gradually coming back to life. People had finished work, schools and colleges had emptied. Some people had already had their dinner. Other people were coming out buying theirs from the sea of takeaways and restaurants situated along the high street. Once finished with the flask, the figure checked through the telescopic sight on the rifle. Below, a young woman stood outside the town pub. The image through the sight resolved, and the figure holding the weapon exercised meticulous care to aim precisely. An index finger curling the trigger squeezed. A crack sounded in the stillness. Initially, it was as if nothing had happened. Then suddenly, people, like ants below, started scattering in all directions. The figure packed up and calmly melted away into the night. Bonnie was heading for the pub when she was nearly knocked over by a police car, whilst negotiating the road. The emergency vehicle hurtled past her, approaching the beginning of the high street. When Bonnie rounded the corner, she could see the road was in the process of being cordoned off. Police attention centered on the pub. Bonnie took her phone out of her pocket and dialed Lily. There was no reply. Bonnie tried once more, her heart pounding. Again, there was no reply. The police stopped Bonnie from getting any closer to the pub, and she had to go home and watch the coverage on the local and later the national news. A knock, and then the bell ringing, alerted Marcus Anderson Pritchard there was someone at the door. He thought it was Lily who had forgotten her key again. When he opened the door and came face to face with two police officers, he was temporarily stunned. He and his wife had only recently spoken to the police about Lily and Bonnie shoplifting. "What's Lily done now?" Marcus asked. "I'm sorry, can we come in?" the male officer said. "Yes, of course," said Marcus, leading them into the sitting room. The female officer asked Marcus to sit down and then explained what had happened on the high street. Audrey returned home from the local shop and entered the sitting room. Her face hardened when she saw the police officers. "What has that girl of ours done now?" The officers stood up and explained the situation to her. Audrey dropped onto the sofa and went into a state of shock. The officers rang for medical assistance, and when a paramedic arrived by motorcycle, he administered a sedative then suggested Audrey should go straight to bed. Marcus sat at his dining table with a brandy. He suddenly burst into tears. Years of henpecking by Audrey had robbed him of his personality. Lily had kept him going. Now, Marcus had nothing. He walked through to his garage and found some strong rope. He headed up the open staircase and tied the rope firmly around the top banister post. A creaking sound echoed off the walls. Then there was silence. Chapter 2. Analysis. Timothy Gordon Hershaw entered as the post-mortem started. 25 years of experience as a forensic pathologist had gained him the admiration and respect of both his peers and his juniors. Most of the colleagues in the room knew him personally or knew of him. He wafted into the room, as if on ice, and slickly changed into a lab coat, donned goggles, a mask and gloves. Rulers, tape measures and vernier caliper gauges were all wielded to verify the presumption that the entry wound on the victim's forehead was precisely in the center. Not approximately, precisely in the center of her forehead. A clinical shot. Or perhaps just a fluke. It was hard to tell. Sean Tanner slumped into the comfortable chair with a lager and a bowl of popcorn. He flipped through the television channels looking for another old film to watch. As he moved forward, he stopped on the latest news. It was about a shooting that had happened in the town. Tanner turned up the volume. A young woman had been killed whilst standing outside the town's public house. The report said that the police had not ruled out the possibility of assassination. Tanner took in the information but flipped to the next channel. It was not his concern. The satellite phone in Tanner's briefcase rang. He answered, it was Volger. Tanner, my friend. How are you? Volger asked. Sean was pleased to hear from the fellow spy. He turned off the television. I'm getting there, thanks for phoning. Tanner crossed the room. How are you doing in your new job? He asked, then set the phone next to his armchair. Volger was now on speaker. I like it, he said. The best thing I ever did, move to London. Hey, you didn't tell me how hot your boss is. I think she wants me to take over your job now you've moved up north. Sean nearly breathed in his drink, very funny. Volger carried on. Hey, Sarah's penciled in a week's holiday for me if you want some company. Are you on first name terms with the boss already? It looks like you've got your feet under the table. Tanner drained his glass and thought about it. You stay where you are, can't have you skiving, you've only just started. Sean chatted with Volger for half an hour before running out of things to say. He did tell Volger of the killing in town, and Volger said HQ2 were well aware of the situation. They wanted to leave it for the local police to handle. Sean plumped the cushions on the hotel bed, found another old film to watch and laid down to rest. He slept. In the evening, Tanner went out. He walked up the high street and cringed at the antics of the young lads driving electric cars with sound packs blasting. Vehicles that should be whisper quiet paraded up and down the street with mock sport or muscle car engine effects set high. One young driver recognized Tanner. The lad from the pub, who Tanner had held by the throat. The lad jumped out of his car and tried to punch Tanner. Tanner dodged the blow. The boy was surprised but kept it up. The lad could not land a punch once, and his friends laughed at his efforts. The boy got back into his electric car and sped off with a thunderous fake roar. Tanner headed for the pub. Chapter 3, Conquest. Sean looked at the girl lying next to him. She was in a deep sleep, snoring gently, the sun coming in through a gap in the curtains told him it was morning. He vaguely remembered the young lady had to get up early for work. He tried to remember the job she did, but it escaped him. Sean knew he should not let her sleep much longer. It was 6 by his watch. He examined her as she slept. She was not a patch on Rebecca, but she was pretty in her way. Tanner tried to piece together events from the night before. Somehow he had managed to come back to the hotel with a young woman in tow. It did not feel much like a conquest on his part. He was feeling guilty and disappointed with himself. Rebecca had been gone for just over 2 weeks, and there he was, sleeping with the first girl who showed him some interest. As the memories started to flood back, he decided the conquest was hers. The previous evening she was eyeing him up in the pub. Tanner saw from his seat at the bar, her mates were egging her on. Eventually, she plucked up the courage to come over and talk to him. He could not recall their conversation, but he was enjoying her company. Of course, it went further than he would have wanted, and now he was kicking himself. She started to stir. Hello, handsome, she said, smiling. Did you sleep well? Sean said without hesitation. Like a log. You must have tired me out. Sean was at a loss as to what to say next, so he leant over and kissed her forehead. It did not feel fake, and his tears welled up. Ah, you're a real softy on the inside. I took you for a macho man when I first saw you. But you had something about you. I couldn't take my eyes off you all night. Sean didn't want to get rid of her as fast as he could, she didn't deserve treatment like that. She was a nice girl, and he wasn't willing to tarnish the time they'd spent together. She probably wasn't expecting it to go anywhere anyway. After all, it was just a one-night stand. I'll call down for some food to be sent up. The chef here does a mean English breakfast. That would be lovely. I don't have to be at work until 8. If I'm a bit late, the others can do without me for half an hour. I am the boss after all. Sean tried to remember the job she did but struggled, so he changed the subject. Have you watched the news recently? Yes, it's shocking. I don't feel safe going out on my own at night. That's why I was with my friends. We've all been looking out for each other since the shooting. Promise me you'll keep doing that, you know, staying with a crowd. Don't worry, I will. Chapter 4, Ian. Ian Carlston put on his jacket and stuffed the last donut into his mouth. He waved goodbye to his friend and exited the cafe. The informal meeting had gone well. Ian had managed to convince his longtime friend into parting with £20,000 to help expand their small business. Vinny was a sleeping partner and wanted no part in the actual running of their business. He was happy to watch from the sidelines and attend the odd meeting every week or two, and as long as they were in profit, he was okay. Ian looked at his watch. It was getting late. His wife had expected him about an hour earlier for dinner. It was now 8 o'clock, he was going to get it in the neck. High on a squalid hotel roof under some damp cardboard boxes, a killer lay. The person had a good view of the town centre. A stainless steel flask was nearby. A businessman below was hurrying. He looked at his watch. Above, a rifle trigger was pulled. The man dropped and lay sprawled on the pavement. A phone in the businessman's pocket rang. Chapter 5, Stupor. Sean Tanner was in and out of consciousness. The television was on, and local news flashes interrupted the schedule regularly. Beer cans were strewn on the carpet, leaving stains as the dregs of liquid leaked out. Through his alcoholic days, Sean could make out what the reports discussed. It seemed a small business owner was the latest victim of the sniper. The media had now realized that this might be the work of a serial killer, and were warning people out at night to be vigilant. The latest victim was a male, so it looked like anyone was fair game. The reporter mentioned that both deaths were due to a head wound. However, they could not release more details because of the ongoing police investigation. The local crime liaison officer tried to reassure people that it was safe to go to work and carry on as usual in the daytime, as the two murders had happened at night. Two police officers, one male and the other female, walked with their police dog towards the morgue. They were due to meet the forensic pathologist Timothy Gordon Hershaw. When they entered, he stopped them in their tracks. "You can't bring a dog into the morgue," he said. "Ranger's with us, he's our police dog," said the male officer. "I don't care if he's running the investigation. He's not coming in. Tie him up outside." The male officer went outside with Ranger and tied him to a railing. Once the officer was back inside, the pathologist took them to see the two victims of the sniper. He pointed out the similarities of the head wounds. "The media might be correct. It looks like you've got a serial killer in town," the pathologist concluded. When the police officers left, they looked for Ranger. He was gone. The female officer picked up the dog lead. "I think someone's stolen him." Ranger returned to the police station later that day with a blood-stained muzzle. Chapter 6, Lucy. Lucy Bradstock went to the pub in the hope of seeing Sean. He did say that they'd see each other again, but now, she was reluctant to make the first move. Although she knew where he was staying, she thought it would look more natural if she happened to bump into him. She waited the whole evening until 11 o'clock, then decided he was unlikely to visit that night. She gathered her things and left. She'd been drinking fruit juices and soft drinks all evening. She was alert but well aware she had no companions. She looked around for familiar faces but couldn't see anyone she knew. She started to feel scared. An abandoned three-story house proved to be a suitable vantage point for the killer. From a loft window, slightly opened, a rifle protruded. Gloved hands wrapped around a flask cup. It was cold. There was no heating, and the damp air was penetrating. A lone female walked furtively below. Through the telescopic sight, her face showed fear. A tear rolled slowly down her cheek. Was she sad, or was it just the cold? The killer hesitated for a moment, then pulled the trigger, a clean, accurate shot, precisely in the middle of her forehead. Things were gathered and packed neatly away. The killer left. Chapter 7. Personal. Tanner went over to the drinks cabinet. He poured himself a large whiskey. It was days since he'd last had a drink, but now he needed one. The newsreader had said a name, and Tanner stopped dead. Lucy Bradstock. That was the young woman he had brought back to his hotel the other night. The news report went on to tell of her background and details of her death. Sean wasn't sure of his feelings, but he could feel anger welling up. It had become personal. That same week, the killer struck again, killing another three women and one man in quick succession. Tanner was beginning to get concerned. It looked like the local police were out of their depth. He would get involved. He couldn't just sit back and watch everything unfolding on television. Lucy was one of the killer's victims. It was time for him to straighten himself out and act. Chapter 8, A Close Call. Tanner entered the small police station and met the desk sergeant. "Hello, Mr. Tanner," the sergeant said, as he shook Sean's hand. Sean followed the sergeant to a small interview room. "Would you like a tea or coffee?" the sergeant asked, gesturing towards the table and chairs. Sean took a seat. "A coffee, please." Tanner looked at the man's name badge. It said Desk Sergeant Mike Planer. Mike poured a coffee and placed it together with cream and sugar in front of Tanner. "Thank you," Tanner paused for a moment. He didn't know how to raise the subject without offending. "How is the sniper investigation coming along?" Mike squirmed a little. "Well, we are short-staffed. London can't spare anyone yet. They said they'll be sending a detective next week." Tanner couldn't believe it. "Just one?" "They said we've got to ask for help from neighboring counties. We contacted all the counties in the surrounding area, but none of them could spare any officers." "What air support have you got?" Tanner asked. Again, Mike looked uncomfortable. "Well, we haven't had access to a helicopter for over 10 years. He poured himself a coffee and sat opposite Tanner. "Our mechanics had a go at making a flying machine a couple of years ago. It looked like a flying bed. They bolted large drones onto an aluminium frame. They only flew it a couple of times, you know, testing it out, but our lads were too scared to go on it." Sean thought for a moment. "Have you still got the flying machine?" "Oh, yes. It's in one of the garages, probably pushed right at the back." Tanner was formulating an idea. "Could I take a look at it?" Mike rubbed his chin and thought. "If you don't mind pulling everything out and putting it all back again, I'll give you a hand." "Oh, I've just remembered, the boys controlled it with a phone and a gamepad. I'll see if I can find those in the stores." At the back of the police station, Sean and Mike stood in front of the flying machine. Car parts and boxes surrounded them. Mike had found the phone and gamepad and quickly charged them in one of the police cars. Tanner paired the gamepad and mobile phone via a wireless connection and then dumped a sack of car parts onto the flying machine. Earlier, Mike had managed to get some charge into the machine's old battery packs. "Here goes nothing," Sean said. To his amazement, the machine slowly rose into the air and hovered. Tanner tried out all the movements the flying machine could perform and slowly brought it back down to the ground. Mike had been watching from a safe distance, shaking his head in disbelief. The two men put everything back into the garages. The flying machine now stood in front of car parts. Tanner returned later that day to fit lights onto the machine's framework. The following evening, Sean Tanner turned up at the police station kitted out for an aerial mission. He was wearing a jumpsuit he'd bought from an army surplus store in town and a brand new motorcycle helmet purchased from the local motorcycle dealership. Tanner had his 9mm gun securely stowed in a map pocket and was keen to get going. Mike had charged and fitted new battery packs to the flying machine. He told Sean that the flying machine only had a flight time of about an hour, so they decided to lift it onto a trailer and tow it to Sean's planned search area. It was dark when Mike and Tanner arrived at the proposed area. They quickly unloaded the flying machine from the trailer, then Tanner sat on top. He opened the control app on the phone, paired it with the gamepad, then popped the phone into his pocket. Using the gamepad, Tanner slowly took the machine up into the sky. The lights he had installed worked well, so he began sweeping in a logical search pattern. 10 minutes into his search, Tanner heard a rifle crack. Suddenly, one of the drones stopped working. Tanner decided to abort the mission. Again, there was a crack of rifle fire, another drone stopped working, and the flying machine tumbled downwards. Red-hot needles seemed to jab at Sean's heart. Beads of sweat ran down his forehead and into his eyes. Breath eluded the spy. "Breathe, breathe, damn it," Tanner thought. Sean landed hard. He felt like a rock had hit him. The ground had torn at his body. His throat and back seared with pain, but even worse was the pain in his chest. A mini lightning storm raged. Mike must have seen the flying machine crash land as he arrived quickly in the police car. He helped Tanner into the car and left the flying machine where it had crashed. Tanner was well enough to avoid a trip to the hospital, but Mike stayed at the hotel with him overnight. The next few days saw Sean Tanner holed up in his hotel room while the killings continued at a pace. Tanner felt useless and unable to do anything to help stop the sniper's rampage. Sean knew he needed time to recover, so he used his laptop and the internet as tools to prepare for his next attempt to snare the sniper. Chapter 9: The Parcel. There was a knock at the door. Sean got out of bed, coughed and struggled to swallow as his throat was sore. He opened the door and saw a parcel on the floor. Bending down to pick it up, he groaned at the shooting pain in his back. Sean sat at the small television unit and carefully opened it. Inside was an infrared telescopic sight he had ordered a few days earlier. Sean checked it over, then put it back in the box. After setting the parcel aside, he made himself some breakfast from the small larder of food he had recently bought. Tanner cursed as he struggled to eat it. The news on his laptop was all centered on the shootings happening in and around the town. It looked like the sniper was starting to move farther into the surrounding area. Sean figured the killer might be running a little scared. If Sean Tanner had anything to do with it, the killer would soon be running a lot faster. Once he had finished breakfast, Tanner did a final check on his equipment and clothing. He was all set for his second mission. This time he would travel on foot and use the infrared scope to search for the sniper. He thought it might pay to concentrate on the outskirts of the town first, as the killer was now moving farther afield. Tanner had asked HQ2 for a high-powered rifle and special ammunition to be sent to his hotel. He would have to wait for that to be delivered, so in the meantime, he would have to make do with what he had with him. He had time on his hands as he planned to set off later that evening. Sean decided to go for a walk. He thought the fresh air might help invigorate him. Sean Tanner walked through the area's biggest public park. It was still quite warm in the afternoons, so he wore a t-shirt and jeans. Coming to terms with the death of Rebecca was proving difficult for him. Looking around at the couples enjoying the last dregs of the summer was painful. He'd pined for Rebecca for years on the alternative Earth, and when he got back to his Earth, he'd only managed to spend a short time with her before she was snatched away in a terrible accident at their home. He couldn't get the image of Rebecca lying at the bottom of the stairs out of his head. Stabbing glass-like pain suddenly attacked his chest. With his head swimming, he stumbled to the nearest park bench. A mature gentleman stood up to steady Sean. "Are you okay, son?" Sean rasped between breaths. "I'll be all right. Thank you." His breathing steadied. "I've been getting the odd twinge lately, nothing to worry about." The older man looked concerned. "You want to get to a doctor? Let them check you over."
"I will."
"Thanks for your concern," Sean said. The gentleman shook Tanner's hand and wished him well. A dull pain still lingered, but Tanner got up from the bench and carried on his walk, although at a moderate pace. He decided to abandon his planned mission and rest up instead. Chapter 10: The Arrival. Brad Manderton sat in his car eating a hot dog. He knew he should have signed in at the small police station early that morning. But he considered himself a law unto himself. After all, he was a top London detective, the last of a dying breed. He'd picked up a local newspaper from a newsagent's near the hot dog stand. He took his time reading it through, getting a feel for the area. Manderton knew a top spy was in town. Colleagues said the man might prove to be of help. He ignored the advice. He didn't need the help from some jumped-up government official. This sniper case needed a real detective. After a nap, he set off for the police station. Desk Sergeant Mike Planer dealt with an angry man who claimed their police dog Ranger had attacked him whilst running loose around town. The man was a known petty thief, so Mike gave him short shrift, threatening to charge him for dognapping. The following person to walk in looked far too slick and smug for Mike's liking. The man came up to Mike's booth. "I'd like to speak to the man in charge," he announced. "The lady in charge is out solving crimes. I'm the only person here at the moment. I'm the desk sergeant, and at present, I'm the man in charge. The name's Brad Manderton, Detective Inspector Brad Manderton. You're probably expecting me." "Yes, this morning," Mike said, to wind the man up. "It won't pay to get smart with me. You country folk should be glad I've turned up. It looks like you've been struggling with this sniper case these last few weeks." Manderton shot Mike a stern look. "Give me everything you've got so far." Mike fetched the case file and put it in front of the detective inspector. The man skimmed through the file and asked for a photocopy. "I'll work away from the station if you don't mind. It feels a little claustrophobic for my liking." "As you wish," said Mike. The man gathered up the photocopied sheets and bid Mike farewell. "What a dick," Mike muttered to himself. Detective Inspector Brad Manderton scrolled through the screen full of results he'd got on his phone. His search for local shooting venues had returned a high number of matches. He figured countryside pursuits were likely to be popular in most rural areas, so there was a lot of legwork to be done. A listing caught his attention. It was a shooting range not too far away from his present location. He got in his car and headed there. He drew up outside a grand old manor house. The outside of the building had dark Tudor-style wooden battens. He walked up to the house, crunching gravel underfoot. A gardener acknowledged him as he rang the bell. A ruddy-faced man answered the door. He wore a green quilted body warmer and seemed flustered. "Can I help you?" he said. "Are you the manager of the shooting range?" "I'm the owner of all you see. I leave the management of the shooting range to my nephew David, but I know as much as he does about how it runs. I'm Detective Inspector Manderton. I'm investigating the shootings that have happened in the last few weeks. Is it okay if I ask some questions?" "You'd better be quick. I've got an appointment in less than an hour." The man led the detective inspector into the manor house and offered him a whiskey. "I don't drink on duty. I'll get to the point of my visit. I want your opinion on who's likely to be carrying out the shootings. A sort of profile. Are there any likely candidates in the town?" "How the hell would I know? It could be anyone. Maybe someone with a grudge of some sort. Have you or your nephew ever had to ask anyone to leave the shooting range?" "Can't say I recall. I don't know of any hotheads wielding guns in these parts. The majority of people I know are quite sensible and responsible when it comes to firearms." An electric all-terrain vehicle pulled up outside in a hail of gravel. A fierce, beefed-up man got out of the car and flashed a look of disdain at the detective inspector. "Who's this geezer?" he said, in an East End London accent. The landowner attempted an explanation but tailed off. "I'm Detective Inspector Manderton, of..." The detective didn't get to finish his sentence. A brute of a fist made contact with his nose. Blood filled Manderton's eyes. He struggled to focus on his attacker. Although unsteady on his feet, he was still standing. "Piss off, you posh twat, leave my uncle alone," the man spat. Detective Inspector Manderton was grabbed by his lapels and dragged off the property. Brad Manderton got in his car and examined his face in the vanity mirror. He was a mess, no one was going to take him seriously. He looked like he'd gone 10 rounds with a heavyweight boxer. He decided to head back to London to get his nose fixed. Chapter 11, The Prodigy. Jackson Vender still waited in his car, wishing Sean Tanner would turn up soon. He was not sure why HQ2 had sent him to babysit the spy. Tanner was not ready to be put out to pasture, and Vender still was sure Tanner would not be pleased to see him. Vender still could see Tanner in the distance. The spy still looked in good shape for a man of 40. Although Sarah Serking had hinted that she needed a replacement for Tanner in the not-too-distant future, Vender still could not quite see it happening. Tanner opened the passenger door, letting in a blast of cold air. "Hi Jackson," he said. "You do realize Sarah Serking sent me?" "I'm not here of my own volition," Vender still said. "Relax, I'm not going to bite." Tanner switched the heating on. "Why does your car smell like a petrol station?" "One of my petrol cans sprang a leak." "Can't HQ2 give you an electric car?"
"I don't like them, they've got no soul," said Vender still.
"And I suppose petrol stations are few and far between," Tanner asked. "Getting fewer by the month." Tanner decided to cut to the chase.
"Did you bring the rifle and ammo?"
"Yes, it's in the boot." "They could have sent it by courier." "There wasn't any need for you to come, was there?" Vender still hesitated.
"Well, perhaps HQ2 thought you might need some help."
Vender still could have kicked himself. He didn't know what else to say.
"Well, I can't blame them.
They know I'm not 100% fit mentally. Losing Rebecca has blunted my edge."
"So you're okay with me being here?" Vender still asked.
"I don't mind us working together on this.
Technically, it's not our mission, we're only helping out because the police aren't up to the job, and I don't mean that in a nasty way. They've been cut to the bone."
"I'm glad you're okay with me being around, I must admit I wasn't sure how you were going to react."
"Don't sweat it. Let's concentrate on stopping the sniper."
Sean Tanner and Jackson Vender still worked together over the following weeks. The sniper proved elusive and spread deeper into the countryside. Their mission became even more difficult. On one evening in mid-October, the two spies walked back to their car, when a near-fatal shot rang out. It hit Vender still in the head, and left him with life-altering injuries. Sean parked on the roof of the multi-story car park. The hospital helipad was below with an air ambulance waiting to take off. Sean took a few minutes to center himself before entering the hospital. He hadn't visited Jackson since he was injured by the sniper. When Sean entered the ward, he knew right away that Jackson would not be returning to work as a spy. The patients on the ward were all affected by head trauma and looked as if they would need months or even years of rehabilitation. Sean spotted Jackson in a wheelchair near one of the windows. He was unresponsive. Sean took a tissue out of a nearby box and wiped the dribble from Jackson's chin. There was no point staying, the Jackson he knew was gone. Chapter 12, Lone Strike. Sean Tanner did not have to be as accurate as the sniper, there was no need for him to showboat. All he had to do was take the person down. He had a weapon in his bag that would do the job nicely. He dug out a small box of rifle cartridges that held a tranquilizer dart within a soft casing. Once the capture bullet hit exposed tissue, the dart would force its way out and into the target. Luckily, the night was still. Tanner looked at the leaves on the trees. There was no movement at all, so he wouldn't have to take wind drift into account. He had dressed for the cold in a black thermal jumpsuit and lay between two bushes with a clear view of the town and surrounding countryside. Sean scanned the area through his scope. After about 20 minutes, he saw movement in the distance, a figure was lying down under a small group of trees on a hill opposite. Sean couldn't believe his luck. He had been searching for almost a month, and now, the killer was in his sight. Sean looked carefully to make sure he had definitely identified his target. A glint of the killer's gun sight confirmed it. Tanner didn't hesitate.
He aimed for the neck and took the shot. The figure fell forward, the rifle was loosened and dropped to the ground. Tanner packed up and headed for his car. Once inside, he set off for the range of hills opposite him. He had made a mental note of landmarks, so he'd have no problem finding the tranquilized killer. Tanner had to be quick. The drug used in the tranquilizer dart would only keep the sniper down for about 20 minutes. A white van parked beside a ditch. Two men dressed in black suits got out. They extinguished their cigarettes on the ground and set off towards a nearby hill. There, they found a figure lying face down under some trees. They dragged the sleeping person to their van, then hauled the figure into the back and shut the doors. Tanner arrived at the scene a few minutes later. He spotted the cigarettes, they were still smoldering. He quickly ran up the hill to the clump of trees to find a rifle and other bits and pieces left by the sniper. The sniper was gone. Sean figured it through. The tranquilizer dart should have knocked the killer out cold for at least 20 minutes. Tanner had only taken 5 minutes to get there, so the sleeping killer should still be under the trees. It began to dawn on Tanner that he may have had assistance from HQ2, perhaps they wanted to clear up for him now he'd got the job done. Maybe they were easing him back. Were they using the sniper situation as an extended training mission? He was at a loss. If they were trying to help, it hadn't worked. It had wound him up. In his book. This was a loose end. He went back to his car with the sniper's belongings and stowed them in the back. As he traveled farther up the road, looking for a place to turn, he could see tire tread on the road. Skid marks weaved down the hill and stopped near a hedge. Tanner stopped the car nearby and got out to investigate. A van was lodged in the hedge over a water-filled ditch. Tanner hesitated, then took a chance. He opened the back doors and stepped inside. The back of the van was empty, but he could see two smartly dressed men in the front slumped forwards in their seats. Tanner cautiously edged forward to take their pulse. They were both dead. Probably strangled. Damn, Tanner cursed. He went back to his car to call it in. How could the sniper have got away? Tanner knew he'd hit home. Unless the killer wasn't alone. Perhaps someone blocked the road and rescued the sleeping sniper. Tanner couldn't figure it out. Tanner's mobile rang, he answered. Sean, are you enjoying my little game? A disguised voice asked. Who is this? Tanner demanded. An old acquaintance, who's repaying a favor. The voice continued. I was there when Rebecca fell down the stairs. I was the one who pushed her. Who are you? Sean blasted. I'm not going to spoil the fun by telling you. My associates and I are having such a ball, toying with you. We're getting you match ready. Are you enjoying your training? Sean thought about the victims. He needed to keep this joker on the line. His mobile had a voice record and an automatic locator built in. It was already homing in on the caller's location. Oh, I am keeping an eye on the time. I'll soon have to bid you farewell. I wouldn't want to give my location away, the caller said. Watch your back. I'm gunning for you, raged Tanner. Now, sweetie, don't lose your cool. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, but I must dash, you know, things to do, people to kill, the line went dead. Tanner checked the locator on his mobile. It was just short of getting an exact location. The caller was within a 20-mile radius.